Hello, Paul Ehrwetter with Medscape Infectious Diseases. I'm from the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. ID Week in San Diego, I think, was a huge success, the most well-attended ever for this meeting, and I think really has captured most of the important clinical and research advances in our field. It was really overwhelming. I was only able to spend the first half of the meeting in San Diego. And so I just wanted to make a few comments that are by no means comprehensive, but just some of the sessions I attended and some of the highlights that sort of impressed me. Without a doubt, the story of Ebola, I think, was clearly something that captured so many of our attentions, not only at the breadth of the experience and reports for the treatment centers, the public health logistics and interventions that have really been able to make such strides over the past year. The personal story was also well captured by Ian Crozier, who related his own experience. And I think the conference really highlighted what has been increasingly reported in the medical literature, and that is that for the survivors of Ebola, clearly, there are both infectious and post-infectious consequences, not only a post-infectious fatigue syndrome or arthralgia syndrome, but also that the virus can persist. Indeed, in Dr. Crozier's case, in his eye, but also that excretion in semen and breast milk may provide important insights and perhaps why Ebola is something that can crop up and continue even after people have apparently fully recovered from their particular infection. So I think this is something which even in a year from now, we'll learn much more. The second was Henry Chip Chambers, who was honored with a named speaker talk, but he gave, I thought, an important lecture, and that was the way that infectious diseases clinical research has been carried out for new anti-infectives or even current anti-infectives has been woefully inadequate often because drugs are approved for conditions for where we don't really use the drugs commonly. For example, ceftolozane tazobactam, a wonderful addition for multiple drug-resistant Pseudomonas, was approved for complicated intra-abdominal infection. That's not something that I think any of us would envision using this for. So he highlighted a paper, which is referenced below, authored with Scott Evans and colleagues, that provided a new model, perhaps, for trying to assess whether a particular anti-infective is worthy and, in fact, perhaps better than current existing treatment using the DOOR and RADAR acronyms. That's the desirability of outcome ranking and response adjusted for duration of antibiotic risk. The idea or concept being that for any given treatment or duration, patients may improve equally on both drugs, but perhaps one drug has more side effects or the recurrence rate is higher in one or another. And these may not be things particularly captured by so-called primary endpoints alone. So I thought it was quite a provocative talk. I think it's certainly worthy of additional discussion. Also, I found, of course, great interest in the endocarditis guideline update, but certainly witnessed that many of the questions that still press us in terms of choices and so on remain really without fundamentally good quality evidence for caring for our patients. Lastly, compared to 2008 and 2012, when only one drug was approved by the Food and Drug Administration, there have now been six in the last 2 years. So I think there was great interest in the new drug talks, including for ceftazidime avibactam, which I think will certainly fulfill a niche for KPCs, ceftolozane tazobactam, its niche seemingly targeted well for helping in Pseudomonas aeruginosa infections with high levels of resistance and perhaps with less toxicities and requiring aminoglycosides or polymyxin compounds. isavuconazine sulfate, active against molds and aspergillus, maybe with a slightly cleaner side effect profile than voriconazole. Limited data against mucor species, but has received an FDA indication because of limited current availabilities, even though only 37 patients were presented to the FDA. Paramivir is an injectable neuraminidase inhibitor approved for uncomplicated influenza. Of course, that's not probably where it will be used. It will be used in severely ill hospitalized patients. We don't have much data other than limited evidence from the H1N1 pandemic era, where the drug looked like it was tolerated, but little could be said about efficacy. So in the next year or two, hopefully with some published studies, we'll get some insights whether this drug is helpful for hospitalized patients, even in those who may have had more than several days of symptom onset. Lastly, for many viral infections that trouble transplant patients, such as adenovirus, there's been woeful strides or concerns with using drugs that are toxic, such as cidofovir, with really minimal improvement in impact. Brincidofovir was reviewed. This is not yet FDA approved, but looked highly exciting in being perhaps more efficacious, also with less toxicity as an antiviral agent for pathogens such as adenovirus and double-stranded DNA viruses, all with much less toxicity compared to cidofovir and available in oral formulation. So just some quick points that impressed me. It's a meeting I always have greatly enjoyed going to and learn lots. Thanks for listening.